Here on Stolen Lives, we discuss brutal and heartbreaking crimes against children. Themes may include child murder, torture, and sexual, domestic and child abuse. I do try my best to remain respectful for the babies in these stories and leave out unnecessary details that honestly, none of us need to know to understand the frustration of why and how this ever happened. However, if you find any of these themes triggering, this podcast may not be for you. Listener discretion is advised. The crime we will be talking about today happened very close in time to another well-known beach-related crime out of Australia, the disappearance of the Beaumont children. And that happened less than 2 weeks after this. These are two crimes that changed the landscape of Australia forever. January 1965, Wonder Beach, Sydney, Australia. Two 15-year-old girls, Christine Sharrock and Marianne Schmidt, spent the day at the beach with Marianne's younger siblings. After lunch, the two teenagers went for a walk into the nearby sand hills but never returned. The following day, their bodies were found in the sand hills. The murders shocked the nation, triggering one of the largest homicide investigations in Australian history. Despite exhaustive police work, the killer has never been identified. And decades on, the murders at Wonder Beach remain unsolved. This is Christine and Marianne's story.
Here at Wonder Beach today, there is practically no trace of the tragedy which has shocked all of Sydney. Behind me, a short distance down the beach, a young man and his nephews yesterday stumbled upon the bodies of the two teenage girls from Ryde buried in a shallow grave.
Helmut and Elizabeth Schmidt immigrated to Melbourne, Australia on September 13, 1958. Arriving from Germany with their six children, Helmut Jr., Marianne, Hans, Peter, Trixie and Wolfgang. The Schmidts were among a number of German families, coming to Australia on an assisted agreement after the Second World War. The family settled into life on the south coast of New South Wales, in the town of Tamora. Their family would have their seventh child around this time, another little boy they named Norbert. Helmut working as a carpenter to support the family, while Elizabeth was a very busy stay-at-home mother. The family's perfect life was hit hard when in March of 1963, Helmut was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. And this is a form of cancer that attacks the lymph glands. The Schmidt family then moved to Brush Road in Ryde, a suburb of Sydney. And sadly, this is where Helmut died of his illness in June of 1964. Living next door to the Schmidt family were Jim and Jeanette Targ, along with their granddaughter Christine Sharrock. Christine's own father had died, and she chose to live with her grandparents instead of her mother and stepfather. Marianne and Christine became fast friends. They realised they had a lot in common. Their birthdays being only a couple of weeks apart, they loved pop music, they both were just discovering boys, and they both had lost their father. In January 1965, Elizabeth Schmidt was admitted to hospital for a major operation. She left the two eldest children, 16-year-old Helmut Jr. and 15-year-old Marianne, in charge of the household and the five other children, while she was recovering in hospital. Saturday, January 9th, 1965, Marianne and Christine, who was also 15, they went to visit Elizabeth in the hospital. While they were there, they asked Elizabeth if they could take the younger children to Cronulla Beach, which is in southern Sydney. And as they were living in the suburbs, this would be the only beach that would be accessible to them by the train. And Cronulla Beach held special significance for the Schmidt family, because they used to go there a lot before Helmut died, and they had already been there at least twice that year, so they knew the area well by themselves. So with that, Elizabeth gave the girls permission to go the following day, on the condition that they were careful and kept an eye on the younger children. However, the next day it rains, so the trip was postponed until the following Monday, January 11th, 1965. The older boys decided not to go on the trip, and instead they stayed home to catch up on some household chores. My children would never. Regardless, Marianne and Christine still wanted to take the remaining four younger Schmidt children to Cronulla Beach by themselves. Christine packs inside her beach bag a thermos of cold juice concentrate, or cordial as we call it in Australia, a beach towel, a plastic purse containing a £1 note, a pair of sunglasses, and a transistor radio. Christine didn't pack any food with her. I'm assuming she planned to share the food that Marianne packed, because we do know that Marianne packed some different types of sandwiches and some fruit to eat at the beach. As Christine was packing her beach bag, she told her grandmother that she was looking forward to walking across the sandhills, like they had on their previous trip to Wanda Beach a few weeks earlier. Christine's grandmother told her not to go, because she had the younger children with her and it was too far for them to walk. We are talking about 4 kilometres or 2.5 miles each way, and with the youngest Schmidt child being Norbert at 5 years old, I can understand that. And add on to that, the weather wasn't the greatest. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. Shortly before 8:30 that morning, Christine, Marianne and the youngest 4 Schmidt children, they walked to West Ryde train station to catch the train to Redfern. The girls were seen talking to a boy that was aged around 15 on the train to Redfern. The boy and the girls going their separate ways there. The boy leaves the train station, and the girls take the connecting train to Cronulla. Now there are 4 beaches in Cronulla. Of course we have Cronulla Beach, then North Cronulla, Illawarra, and finally Wanda Beach. If you're coming from Cronulla train station, Wanda Beach would be the furthest from the train station, about 8 kilometres or 5 miles from where the beaches start. But it was the sand hills here that the girls seemed most interested in that day. So just before 11 a.m, the group arrived at Cronulla. They find that Cronulla Beach was actually closed due to the dangerous surf conditions because it was quite windy that day. The girls still lead the younger children to the southern end of the beach. Here they leave their bags into their towels by the rocks. After a quick swim in the shallow end of the beach, they eat their sandwiches and the fruit. It was then Marianne brought up the idea of going for a walk in the sandhills. The group leaves their bags behind. They hide them behind some rocks and they walk past North Cronulla Beach and Illawarra until they arrive at Wanda Beach. It's about 1 p.m. at this point, and the group are literally minutes away from the Wanda Beach Surf Club. This is when the younger children start to complain that the wind is causing the sand to hit their legs and it hurt. And anyone who has been to a beach on a windy day, it isn't the most pleasant of experiences. It actually really does hurt. Marianne told the children to shelter behind one of the smaller sand dunes that lead up to the sand hills. She told the children she would go back to Cronulla Beach with Christine to get their bags so they could go home. They cover the younger children with their towels and leave them to play with Christine's transistor radio. However, instead of heading south towards Cronulla Beach, the two girls head off north into the sandhills. The younger children call out to them that they're going the wrong way, but the girls just laugh and keep on going into the sandhills. This would be the last time Marianne and Christine would be seen alive. 13-year-old Peter, 9-year-old Trixie, 8-year-old Wolfgang and 5-year-old Norbert. They wait near the sandhills for several hours before the walk back to the southern end of Cronulla Beach. They found their bags, along with Marianne and Christine's wallets and train tickets. They were all untouched. The girls hadn't returned as they had promised. The children go back to the train station in time for the last train back at 6 p.m. They arrive home some time after 8. At that time, the eldest child, Helmut Jr., was still visiting their mother at the hospital. It would be Hans who went next door to tell Christine's grandparents that the girls were missing. Christine's grandmother, Jeanette Targ, she assumed the girls had just missed the train, and because they didn't have their ticket anymore, they were most likely stranded in Cronulla. Which, I mean, that would probably be the assumption I would make as well. Jeanette called her son because she wasn't sure what to do. She didn't have a car, and Elizabeth was in the hospital. Jeanette's son told her to call the police. So the police didn't attend the Targ home until almost midnight. By that stage, Helmut Jr. had also gotten home from the hospital. The police immediately assuming the girls had run off with some boys or maybe went to a home of a friend. Helmut Jr. was adamant that this was not a possibility, although entries in the girls' diaries do support that they met 2 boys at Cronulla Beach on New Year's Day. and this meeting parted with a kiss and a promise to meet again. Helmut Jr. also told police that Marianne walked across the sand hills that day and no one could find her for some time. So I can understand the police's line of thinking. Doesn't make it any less urgent of a missing person's search though, in my opinion. Regardless, on that day they hadn't seen Marianne talk to anyone in particular. The police did ask to speak to the younger children, but again Helmut Jr. said no, that they were too tired and the police needed to come back the next day. Which, on the surface level, that does seem a bit strange, because I would assume there would be some concern about the girls' whereabouts. And it did seem that Helmut Jr. didn't think the girls ran off. Yet he didn't seem to have any urgency in finding out where they were. This could be more related to his age. Helmut Jr. was only a teenager himself, and he may have been overwhelmed and annoyed with having to look after the younger children. The next day, January 12, 1965, an older teen, Peter Smith, took his young nephews for an early morning walk along Wanda Beach and along the sandhills. One of his nephews pointed out what looked like someone lying partially buried in the sand, and it pretty much looked like both feet and an elbow sticking out of a mound in the sand. Peter noticed that the body was face down. He first thought it was a mannequin. He went over and brushed some sand away from the head area and realised he was actually looking at a human body. He didn't spend a lot of time looking around though, so didn't realise at the time that she was murdered. Regardless, he just grabbed his nephews and left as quickly as he could. He went to the nearby Wanda Beach clubhouse, thinking that this may have been a drowning victim that had been washed up during high tide. From the clubhouse, the police were called, and when they went to the scene, they realised there were actually 3 feet visible, and that there was another body nearby. They hadn't been buried so much as just kind of covered with sand that had been blown away. Police noticed there was a 34-metre long drag mark, or around 37 yards, and this went back to where the girls were found. Blood was also found on these drag marks. Based on the positioning, the theory was that while Marianne had been attacked, Christine tried to run. The perpetrator chased after her and attacked her before dragging her back to where Marianne was. The autopsy showed that Christine had been hit on the back of the head and her skull had been fractured. It is possible that this is how the attacker incapacitated her in order to drag her back by hitting her on the head. Christine was stabbed at least 6 times. Marianne had been stabbed at least 14 times, and with one of the wounds penetrating her heart, her throat had also been severely cut. There was also obvious attempts of rape on both the girls, with their pants being cut or removed. Sperm was also found on their bodies. However, the autopsy showed that penetration never occurred. Both girls' hymens were still intact. Now, interestingly, Marianne had packed sandwiches for the day, and they brought all this food for everyone. But the contents of Christine's stomach had celery and cabbage in them, and this was not something the girls had taken with them. They also didn't have any money with them to buy food. Christine also had a blood alcohol level of 0.015, which is what you would expect from a glass of beer. It was determined that it was from drinking alcohol and not from the vegetables fermenting in the digestive tract. So at some stage, at least one of the girls had been drinking. There was, however, no alcohol found in Marianne's stomach. The police took the kids back to the beach and across the sandhills, trying to retrace the steps of that day. And 7-year-old Wolfgang remembered that he'd seen the girls walking into the sandhills with a boy who was aged about 16 years old. He had fair or light brown hair and a smooth shaven face. He was wearing light grey trousers, no shirt, and he was carrying a blue towel. But there are some problems with Wolfgang's story. Because firstly, he was 7, and he was the only one of the younger children who had seen the young man. And also his story would change and kind of get bigger the more they talked to him about it. 2 days after he was first interviewed, Wolfgang told investigators that he had seen the same boy on the beach earlier that day. Wolfgang said that this boy was hunting for crabs with a homemade spear gun, and he also had a knife and a holster. That he had seen the boy walk back out of the sandhills 10 minutes after the girls went in there, and that his knife was now missing. Then in another story, when the girls had been gone about 10 minutes, Peter had sent Wolfgang to look for them. And that's when he saw the boy walking back and he claimed he talked to him. He said he asked the boy where the girls were, but the boy just ignored him and walked past. This changing and evolving story is what you would expect from a 7-year-old who just really wanted to help. Now, one of the younger children did see someone else while they were waiting for the girls, which took hours. While they were waiting, Peter asked Trixie to go see if she could see the girls coming back. And this is miles of sand hills. It's not easy to just see. But she went up and looked over, and she saw two boys sliding down the sand hills. But this lead wouldn't go anywhere. This really was just two innocent kids playing on the sand hills. Investigators tried to build an identikit sketch of the suspect to release to the media. They worked with Wolfgang, but this didn't go well. Like I keep saying, he was only 7, and he probably just really wanted to help. He hadn't seen this boy for that long. In the end, he pretty much was just agreeing with the suggestions that were put in front of him. And even so, the sketch was far too vague to be of any use. They got Peter to sit with him as well, to see if having his brother there would help him remember, or just to be calm and to do the sketch. But this resulted in Wolfgang just agreeing with everything Peter said. I don't know how accurate this sketch actually is. If even there was a boy, that if Wolfgang did see anyone else that day. All of that has to be taken into question. Wednesday, January 13th, 1965, 2 days after the murders. The information about the crimes were released to the media, along with a description of the person of interest based on Wolfgang's statements. The media described the person of interest as a 16-year-old surfer with long blonde hair. The problem with this is, at that time and that location, this described almost every teenage boy in the area. It was a very generic description. The largest reward to date in Australia was announced at £10,000. And in today's money, we're talking about $165,000 Australian dollars, or around $110,000 US. And because of this generic description, and the large amount of money being offered, thousands of tips came through. Among these tips was one from a local fireman, Dennis Dorstein. Dennis was walking towards Wanda Beach with his 5-year-old son when he noticed two girls walking between the sand hills. It was around 12:45 p.m. and about 400 metres from the eventual crime scene. These girls matched the descriptions of Christine and Marianne. However, Dennis reported one of these girls kept looking behind her as if they were being followed, and they seemed to be walking at a fast pace. Now, as with any high-profile crime, rumours and false confessions did come in. January 15th, 1965, so we are now 4 days after the murders. A local newspaper reported that an 18-year-old boy with long blonde surfy-style hair was being held at a police station in Brisbane, but that turned out to be just a rumour. Now, it is common for police to withhold key details and open investigations. This allows the police to sort through people who are really involved in the crime from those who are maybe looking for attention or maybe mentally unstable. And this case was no different. In the initial investigation, the police had 5 different men come forward. They all were claiming to have committed the Wanda Beach murders. But investigators were able to discount these confessions because the men knew nothing of the crime outside of what was reported in the media. Police were also looking at a few different men. They searched for a man aged about 25, with light brown hair and of medium build. He had a somewhat flushed or red, ruddy complexion and missing teeth. He had approached several women on the day and offered them money for sex. A second, larger man wearing grey trousers with long hair and stubble. He also approached several women on the day Christine and Marianne died. He would tell these women he was from South Australia, and he asked them for sex. Now, the description of both these men did seem similar to what Wolfgang saw, with the light brown hair and the grey trousers. Maybe he had seen these men or other men and just created this one person in his head because he felt maybe he was doing a good thing by telling police there was someone. I'm not sure. Look, there is no blame here for Wolfgang. This would have been an extremely overwhelming time for anyone, let alone a young child. There is a picture from the newspaper of the kids walking along the beach, and it's a picture that has stayed with me for many years. It's such a really sad photo. I will add it to the Facebook and Instagram post for this episode. But it has stayed with me as one of those pictures that always tug at my heartstrings every time I see it. There were also some other interesting characters on the beach that day. There was a naked man seen walking out of the sandhills and masturbating on the beach in the weeks following the murders. The police publicly announcing they wanted to speak to all of these people, but of course none of them came forward. The problem remaining, there was no eyewitnesses besides Wolfgang's alleged sighting, and there was very little in the way of physical evidence at the crime scene. Police used a front-end loader to work through tons of sand around the crime scene. But again, this is the 1960s, and the search didn't have any of the modern sophistication that we have the luxury of today. There was an old knife with some blood on it found in the sand. But despite what the media reported at the time, the knife had no links to the murders. A sliver of steel that was possibly from a kitchen knife was found. But again, it was never able to be linked to the murders. Saturday, January 19th, 1966, so a year later, the body of Wilhelmina Kruger was found in the basement of a Wollongong parking lot. And this is about 63 kilometres or 39 miles away from Wanda Beach. Wilhelmina was a 57-year-old cleaner, and she had started her shift at the Piccadilly Arcade Shopping Centre in the early hours of that Saturday morning. Shortly before 6 a.m. Wilhelmina was found bludgeoned and stabbed to death at the bottom of a stairwell. She'd also been strangled with her own stockings. Investigators who are on this case, and many of these investigators had also been in the Wanda Beach investigation. So these investigators came out at a press conference and said it was quite possible these cases were linked. And what these reasons are, I'll get to shortly. The next month, another murder happened in the area. February 26, 1966, the decomposed body of Anna Dalinkoa was found by the side of the old Illawarra Highway at Menai. And this is closer to Wollongong than where Christine and Marianne were killed. But Anna's body remained hidden for several days before the killer returned and moved it closer to the highway, probably so it would be discovered. Anna had been last seen 10 days before her body was found. She was leaving a bar or a nightclub. She had been stabbed and mutilated. The police determined that Anna and Wilhelmina's murders were linked and that they were killed by the same person. In looking back on these cold cases in 1990, the Australian Institute of Criminology said that the police did suspect that these two murders plus the Wanda Beach murders were linked. And there are a couple of similarities. Firstly, all four of the bodies were dragged to where they would be eventually found. Secondly, there was no serious attempts made to conceal the bodies. Thirdly, they all happened in the same basic area. And finally, sexual molestation occurred after the murders. Now this last one was uncommon enough, that for four murders in the same area in about a year. It's not really a stretch to suspect that they are connected. And I'm sure there's more reasons the police believe the cases are linked than what they're releasing to the media. In particular, in how Anna was mutilated. There were some rumours that there may have been mutilation in the Wanda Beach murders as well. But as I said, these were never confirmed by police, so we cannot know for sure. And then in June 1966, 19-year-old Carol May Orphan's naked body was found on a bypass road in Wollongong. Like with the other victims, Carolyn had been raped, strangled and beaten to death with a large rock after leaving a Wollongong dance. And that brings us to our first person of interest, Alan Raymond Bassett. Alan Raymond Bassett was 21 years old when he was subsequently charged with Carolyn's murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. Bassett was later diagnosed with schizophrenia and was transferred to Morisset Psychiatric Hospital in Newcastle. There was an inquest into Wilhelmina's murder in September 1966, and it was determined that there were similarities between Wilhelmina's and Carolyn's murders. Bassett denied being involved in any other murder besides Carolyn, but one of the detectives, Cess Johnson, he was involved in the Wanda Beach investigation, and he was convinced Bassett was involved. that Bassett knows more about Marianne and Christine's murders than he is letting on. It must be said, though, that other detectives that were involved in the case, they don't believe Bassett is involved. But for Detective Johnston, Alan Raymond Bassett gifted him a painting. And this is where the majority of the apparent clues are coming from. Detective Johnston would regularly go and visit Bassett at Morissette Hospital. And on one of these visits, Bassett does give Johnston a painting. It was a bush scene that he titled A Bloody Awful Thing. Johnston believed that the painting had in it some grass with blood on it, a broken knife, and hidden in the painting the bodies of four women that he believed was Christine, Marianne, Wilhelmina and Anna. Now I've seen the painting and I can see what is pointed out, but I also think this could be confirmation bias, that Detective Johnston was looking for something and so he found something in there. It's like if you look at the clouds and you see one thing, but then someone else says, "Don't you think it looks like a dinosaur?" And then all of a sudden, you can see a dinosaur in the clouds. I don't feel like any of the things in the painting were so obvious. But Bassett's own father was convinced his son was responsible for the murders, and he went on national television with his suspicions. He actively fought against his son's day release from prison in the 1980s. Bassett was eventually released from prison in 1995, and since his release, Bassett has offered to give his DNA to clear his name. But whether or not he has been cleared as a suspect, that's never been released to the public.
He is Christopher Wilder, a man the FBI calls extremely active and very dangerous.
Another suspect in this case was serial killer slash spree killer Christopher Wilder. He's also known as the Beauty Queen Killer. And people familiar with his crimes won't be currently yelling at their speakers that Wilder is an American serial killer. And you may be right, but Christopher Wilder is also actually Australian. As a teenager, he pled guilty to a gang rape in Australia and was given probation.
We feel that this man is a compulsive killer who must stab and have sexual intercourse with his victim as an overall part of the act.
In 1969, when he was about 24 years old, he moved to America with dreams of becoming a race car driver. He had multiple convictions in the United States for sex offences, but he was never sentenced to any jail time despite his repeat offences. In at least one of these cases, he lured a young woman by promising her a modelling contract. In 1982, Wilder returned to Australia and he allegedly kidnapped two teenage girls, and he forced them to pose for pornographic photos on a Sydney beach. And I say allegedly because he was not convicted for these crimes. His family posed a $35,000 bail, and he fled back to America. While over there, he conducted a six-week rape and murder spree across the United States, where he killed at least eight young women. Eventually, a woman he abducted in Massachusetts escaped, and able to provide a description of him and his vehicle. At a gas station in New Hampshire, he was spotted by two state troopers who recognised him from the broadcasts about him. They approached him. He went for his gun, and one of the troopers grabbed him from behind. In the scuffle over the gun, two shots discharged. One went through Wilder and also injured the trooper. The second went through Wilder's chest. He died, but thankfully the trooper recovered, and the shooting was ruled an accident. Now, back in the mid-60s when the Wanda Beach murders occurred, and then the possibly two linked murders a year later, Christopher Wilder was about 20 years old. He was blonde and thick-set, and he was living in Sydney. He was apparently a good match for one of the composites that was completed of the Wanda Beach suspect. However, we don't know a whole lot about the description used for the sketch that was matched to him. As I said earlier, the description did come from a seven-year-old who saw him briefly, maybe. And outside of that, there isn't a whole lot of evidence for Wilder. Most recently, convicted murderer and pedophile Derek Ernest Percy was named as a person of interest in the Wanda Beach murders. Percy was a really terrible person. Up until his death in 2013, Percy was convicted of the mutilation murder of 12-year-old Yvonne Tui on a Victorian beach in 1970. He was described by a prison officer as Australia's Hannibal Lecter, and that should give you some indication of what type of guy this man was. Percy was found not guilty on the grounds of insanity, and although he was never convicted, he became Australia's longest-serving prisoner, as every psychiatrist who spoke to Percy found him too dangerous to ever be released. In Percy's prison cell, they found notebooks where he wrote about detailed plans for the murders of children, and it was deemed that there was no way he would have just written about the crimes in a fictional sense, that he most likely had carried them out, that Percy had likely just wiped any knowledge of doing these crimes from his memory. And he does play that fact up when he was being interviewed about suspected crimes. Because besides the murder of Yvonne Toohey, he's also a person of interest in the disappearances of the Beaumont children in January of 1966. He was in that area when they went missing, and he does look scarily like the composite sketch of that suspect. He's also a person of interest in the murders at Wanda Beach, and also 3-year-old Simon Brooke in Sydney in May 1968. And with these two crimes in particular, Percy did go on the record and say that he may have committed these murders, but he couldn't remember. He did admit he drove past where Simon's body was found, and at the time of the Wanda Beach murders, it is suspected he was in Sydney with his father at a boat show. Percy's grandmother lived less than 2 kilometres, or 1 mile away from where Christine and Marianne both lived. And if he was staying there, he would have travelled on the same train as the girls did to the beach that day. Percy is also a person of interest in the murder of 6-year-old Alan Redstone in Canberra in September 1968, and the disappearance of 8-year-old Linda Stilwell in Melbourne in August of that same year. Percy has since been declared Linda's killer in a coronial inquest in 2014. Honestly, I could do an entire podcast series of the crimes or suspected crimes of Derek Percy. If you would like an episode on any of these stories I've mentioned in today's episode, please see my Patreon for more information on how to submit a case suggestion.
Killer Derek Ernest Percy died in hospital early this morning, taking his grisly secrets to the grave. As 10 News revealed last week, he'd been riddled with cancer. Despite repeated efforts from police and a bedside coronial hearing, he revealed nothing about unsolved child murders.
Now, despite all of these murders of children within a 4-year period, Australia was still considered an innocent, safe place during the 1960s. It is possible that the same person could be responsible for some of these disappearances and murders. But looking through the list, there is a difference between a young child like in the case of Simon Brooke and 2 teenage girls like in the case of Wanda Beach. Or even 1 teenage girl like with Yvonne Toohey. Is it possible Percy was involved? I'm not sure. I'd like to believe that one person did everything. I don't want to think that such evil is split into 3 or 4 different people. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. There are other possibilities other than a serial killer. And one of these possibilities is that the girls saw something they shouldn't. It is possible that the girls were walking on the sandhills, even though it doesn't explain why they were walking on the sandhills anyway, away from their bags, but regardless. But did they see something they shouldn't have? The sandhills at Wanda Beach were remote, and on a windy day where there weren't any swimming and the surf wasn't good for surfing, there wouldn't have been a lot of people there. These sandhills gave privacy. There would be nude sunbathers, people engaging in sex acts, and people selling and using drugs. All of these people could be found there. And an example I want to bring up is in the 1960s in Australia, homosexuality was illegal. And the sandhills would have allowed someone to be anonymous. Having places to meet without the fear of being arrested or having your name smeared through the community would have been a big deal. With regards to the sandhills, cars could park behind them, so this allowed for even more privacy, but also the ability to leave very quickly. So perhaps the girls went over the sandhills for one reason, and they stumbled on people engaging in illegal behaviour. There were rumours that the girls could have snuck away into the sandhills looking for sex or drugs themselves. I don't find this likely at all. If you look at the girls' lives before the incident, as well as the autopsy results, it doesn't add up. Neither had drugs in their systems, and both were still virgins. They were known as good girls. They got good marks in school. They helped look after the younger kids in the area. They just weren't the types to do things like that. They were the types that make plans to go to the beach and take all the little kids with them. Detectives went to both girls' schools and interviewed all the students and teachers. there was this theory that the girls maybe had agreed to meet with someone they knew at the beach that day, and then went off into the sandhills for a secret rendezvous. The problem with this scenario, the girls weren't supposed to go to the beach at all that day. They were supposed to go the day before on the Sunday, but the weather was too bad. And this is the time before cell phones and social media. They wouldn't have been able to DM their friends and say, hey, we're going tomorrow. So the likelihood of this being a secret date, it's highly unlikely. Unfortunately, Marianne's mother died of cancer. However, her siblings are still advocates for both Marianne and Christine. They are still trying and hoping to find some real answers as to what happened that day. I just can't imagine that there will be any. The DNA samples they did have would be degraded. These samples wouldn't have been kept the way they should have been kept back then because the investigators didn't know what would happen with our DNA technology. The technology may never catch up to give us the answers and to give Marianne and Christine some justice. If you have your own thoughts and theories on the story we discussed today, or any stories we talk about here on Stolen Lives, please search Stolen Lives Podcast on Facebook, like the page so you don't miss an episode, and join the Stolen Lives discussion group to talk about your thoughts and theories. You can also talk to us on Instagram, Stolen Lives Podcast. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you share this episode on your social media of choice, and subscribe and leave a positive review on your podcast app. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Ali. Hosting and production was also by me, Ali. Music is by Mayu.